continue. So I've been talking about leakage detection. I haven't been talking about how to actually get the key from the card or from the target. So that's where things like correlation power analysis, differential power analysis come in. It relies a bit on statistics. Let me know if you really lose track. It's mostly standard concepts like the average of something or the standard deviation, correlation. What we're actually going to be doing when we're doing a CPA attack is, there's two things that are happening. On the left-hand side is reality. So I have an actual device, there's an actual key in there, I send it an actual message, it will do an operation on it with that key, produce all kinds of intermediate steps. So for instance, in AES, you have all the round keys that are being generated, you have intermediate stages between the rounds of the data, half encrypted, not yet entirely. And in the end, all those things will lead to some kind of actual power use. So that's what we're capturing with the oscilloscope. Now, on the other hand, we have the attacker. And the attacker is, in the case of DPA, assumed to know the algorithm, so you know that it's AES-128, and you know that the message that's going in to the plain text, but you don't know the key, and that's what you want to get out. What we can do as an attacker is we can assume that a certain key is true. We don't know it, so we just assume key 01 is true, or is the actual key. We can simulate what would happen in the algorithm if it was implemented, and we can simulate what kind of power model or what kind of power we would be observing if this was the actual key. And then we just run a simple test. If these are similar, then my key guess was correct. If they're not similar, then I gotta try something else. Now, of course, there's a problem with this. And the main problem is that the way I explained it, I would have to try every different key, which in AES is 128 bits, which means we won't be home before lunch. So we need to do something more. But just keep this in mind. We have the reality of what we measured. We're going to make some hypothesis on a key and then model what we think the power is. There's one critical thing missing, which is breaking this key down into smaller bits. So just for you guys, for your information, so when I'm saying simulate the power as an attacker, we can actually choose all kinds of very simple to very complicated models. So if you're into hardware design, you might be thinking about simulating the actual power consumption of the gates and all that kind of cool stuff. I'm not talking about that. It's actually a much more simpler model, more like what we talked about this morning, like the power consumption of my device is related to the Hamming weight of a certain data value. So I'm basically mapping, for instance, a byte, 8 bits, onto 9 different power values, 0 to 9. Sorry, 0. Yeah, 0 to 8, so 9 different values. So that would be a Hamming weight model. Now, how do you, as an attacker, actually know if that's real or not? Well, you can test it, first of all. But the nice thing is that a lot of devices, just by CMOS technology, share similar characteristics. So the Hamming weight model and the Hamming distance model, which I won't go into right now, but those are common models that you can just try as an attacker, and you can see whether they work or not. And that's typically how we do it. We have a little bit of knowledge on if you're looking at a software implementation, typically it's Hamming weight leakage. If you're looking at a hardware implementation, it's Hamming distance leakage. So those kind of guidelines also help you in choosing the right models. And then we have to somehow, when we've modeled this, we have to do this check whether it's similar to reality or not. So again, there's different techniques that we can use. So DPA, the original DPA is differential power analysis, so that's actually difference of mean. I'm going to be talking about CPA, correlation power analysis, which is just another way of matching my predicted power consumption to reality. So let's say we have the following. So we have taken these power traces. In this case, we're only going to look at 8 bits. So I have some plain text that I send in of 1 byte. I'm just going to ignore the other bytes. And they have some different values, and you get different power consumption because of those values and because of noise and all the other factors that I talked about. So we're going to assume a Hamming weight model. So instead of looking at the actual bits, I just calculate the Hamming weight of that value, and that's going to be my power consumption. And then we're going to do this matching using correlation. And what I actually do is I take all these Hamming weights, so these correspond to the Hamming weight of a certain plain text, and it corresponds to the power trace that originated by sending that plain text. And I'm going to see if there's a correlation between that Hamming weight and, at one point in time, all the power consumptions. And I just execute that for every point in time. So here I do it for t equals 0, then I do it for the next value, and the next one, and so that way I build up my complete picture. And this is just math. I mean, it's not hard. You just calculate the correlation between the two vectors for each time index, and then you get that. The nice thing about this is if there's a statistical relation between all these Hamming weights and all the power consumptions in a specific point in time, this correlation will actually go up just by the nature of the statistics. So what you're seeing in the graph on the right, there's this spike just before the 50 value. So apparently there, the power correlation is strong, or the predicted power of the Hamming weight is strongly related to the actual power. So we have some kind of indication that something's going on there. So when we say we've detected leakage, we've actually detected that there's a statistical relation between the power consumption and the Hamming weight value. Just to confuse you guys, I'm going to talk about this. Actually, not just to confuse you guys, but we've had these slides for a while, and I think nobody bothered to update them for AES. This applied exactly the same to AES as to this. We just changed this picture slightly to fit AES. The side channel part is really similar. So DES has 16 rounds. You won't be using it, hopefully. Maybe if you're using it, you'll be using triple DES, which is 3 times this. Still a little bit weaker than AES, but at least a little bit more resistant. We'll just focus on one of the triple DES. So we have 16 rounds here. This has a 56-bit key, and then each round has a what's called round key, which is a subset of those 56 bits, namely 48 bits. And the magic happens in this f function that you see in the middle. So DES takes 64 bits as input, then does an initial permutation, basically shuffles the bits around, and it makes 2 halves, which we call left and right, and 1 half right goes through the f function, and that's actually where the key gets mixed in. So again, remember that we need known data. So we are supposed to know what goes into the DES algorithm, but we're not supposed to know the key. So let's zoom into the f function. Now, yeah, maybe good to realize that means that we also know the input to this f function because the key hasn't been mixed in yet. So all the flow can be followed. So this is what this f function looks like. So on the top right, you have 48 bits of round key coming in. The top left, you have this right half that's coming in, which is 32 bits. These 32 bits get expanded through some algorithm. And then the key gets mixed. So in the previous slide, we could if we know the inputs, we know what happens in the initial permutation, so we know what goes into the f function. So we know those 32 bits. We know what it looks like after the expansion. We don't know anymore what happens after the key gets XORed in. So this is where the key gets mixed in with known data, and after that, we're lost. We can no longer predict what the values are that are below this key addition. There's also some, just to go through the mechanics, so we have 48 bits that at this point are unknown. These get split up into 8 chunks of 6 bits. These go through what are so-called S-boxes. There's basically a map from 6 bits to 4 bits. Just replace these, the particular value of 6 bits with 4. And then these all go permutated, and that's then the output of the F function. So that's kind of how this whole thing works. But again, we don't know what's happening at the bottom there because the key was mixed in, and that's what we're actually trying to find out. So the trick here now is we're just going to guess a key, but we're not going to guess a 48-bit key. Because the nice thing about DES, it splits it up into 8 times 6 bits. We're actually going to guess 6 bits of the key. So in the example on the slide, we pick S-box 2, and we're going to guess that the key has some 6-bit value. So from now on, let's assume that the key is, I don't know if there's something in the slide, but if it's 0000, 0000000, 6 times 0. Now, under that hypothesis, we can calculate what the output of that S-box is. Because again, we know the input data, we guessed 6 bits of the key, we know what the S-box looks like, so we can calculate what the output of that S-box should have been. And now we're going to use that correlation trick. So instead of, when you look at this, I didn't specify where this Hamming weight came from when we're going through this example. So this Hamming weight might just as well be the output of that S-box for which I have a key guess. Right? I can calculate what the outcome is and can calculate the Hamming weight. I just don't know yet if that key guess is correct or not. But if I run my correlation calculation and I see a spike, that means that the output of the S-box actually is correlated to reality, to the traces that I've taken. So that actually gives some evidence that the guess that I took for that key was correct. If I took a wrong key guess, I'm actually not going to see any relation to the reality. Because a wrong key guess means I predict the wrong output of the S-box, which, because the S-box actually garbles it up quite a bit, I'm going to break the relation with reality. So I'm going to see more of a flat line in the correlation. Now, so in the ideal case, for any 6-bit guess that you have a nice, beautiful correlation spike, and for all the rest, you have nothing. And then you're done. Then you can just pick out what the 6-bit key was. In reality, you have noise and you have all kinds of things. So what we're actually looking at, not whether there is a peak or not, but we're just looking at what's the highest peak. And we use that as the best key guess. In fact, we can go one step further and say, well, we're not going to look at the best key guess, but we're just going to look at a ranking of all the subkeys for that one particular S-box. So for each S-box, we now get a list of 64 candidates that are ranked from high confidence to low confidence, and then we can do some brute forcing, which is another interesting topic, but not for today. Anyway, so the key really here is I'm guessing a very small value, I'm guessing only 6 bits, and I have some way of verifying whether that guess is correct or not. So now all I need to do is kind of rinse and repeat this. So I can do this for one S-box, calculate it. I get the key for that one. But I do that now for Xbox One, and I do it for Xbox 3, and all the way up to 8. So instead of finding 48 bits in one go, which is 2 to the power 48 possibilities, which nowadays is brute forceable, but it's a lot more than the 6 bits I need to guess, which is 64 possibilities, times 8, which is 512. So I only need to, with side channel information, I only need to brute force 512 different key values. So it's entirely feasible to do that really, really quickly. Of course, assuming that my leakages or my correlation spikes are good. So to go over that again, so for a certain key hypothesis, I calculate the output of these S boxes, I calculate the Hamming weight over that, and then I calculate the correlation from the Hamming weight of those S box outputs to the actual trace. And I either get a spike or I don't. In this example, this is what you actually see when there's, when you've, well, there can be two things. So you pick the wrong key, so you try the next one, or there's no leakage. Of course, it can also be that if your device is resistant against these attacks, all your correlation values are going to be flat. And then, yeah, as an attacker, you haven't learned anything. So in this example, you actually see, it's kind of hard to tell, but you see in this case that hypothesis 56, you see some spikes happening there, and the largest spike is actually a negative correlation spike, which we find fine. We're just actually looking at the magnitude, not so much the sign of it. So if we see these 64 traces, we can say, well, 56 looks like the best hypothesis. So let's pick that one and move on to the other S boxes. Obviously, we don't do this by hand. So this is all just number crunching and machine and peak detection and all that stuff. The algorithms are fairly straightforward, and you can just look this up. But really the main takeaway here is that with the added information that you get from the side channel, you can break down this huge brute forcing problem of, you know, 56 bits for this. I guess I can't call that huge anymore, but same works for AES. You take 128 bits, you break it down into individual chunks that you can brute force individually. And then you just combine all those results and out comes the key if your device is leaking. So you're just breaking it down into many smaller problems. And then you just rinse and repeat. Maybe to explain quickly for AES as well. So for AES, it's fairly similar actually. So instead of having the round structure like this with F functions, in AES you have this matrix, which is 4 by 4 bytes, 16 bytes basically. And the first thing that happens is that goes through a round key addition. So AES mixes in the full key. And then in the next step, usually you have the S boxes. So in just like in DES, you have these lookup tables or other ways you can calculate it where it maps one value onto another value. And then you predict the output of that value. You go back to your correlation traces and you see again whether your prediction showed up in reality or not. So in AES, you're picking 8-bit key chunks at a time out of 128-bit key. So that's 16 key bytes you need to learn, basically. So it's a little bit more complex, I mean, but you know, not hugely. One other thing to really realize is that if you're only looking at brute forcing resistance, adding one bit to the key doubles the effort of brute forcing. You double the amount of work an attacker needs to do. Here it only grows linearly. If I add another S box, you know, to my key, then I just need to brute force one more S-box, which is another 6 bits I need to go through. So adding more bits doesn't help so much in side channel when you have side channel information. Okay, let me see. So I want to really quickly do a demo of CPA just to show that it works, because I also want to make sure that we get through the countermeasure section as well. Now, I've already shown on the traces that I took that I can't do CPA. That was that first order analysis that I did that it could not find the key. I was smart enough to take an acquisition earlier. Check save here. No, what's going on? Check save here. And this one that has been processed actually already. So you still see the 10 rounds. It just looks a little bit differently. That's because I've done some resampling and alignment as well. And if I do the first order on that, I'll just show you the results. So this is for AES. So you see, if you just focus on one of these things, you see for one key byte, in this case the one at column 0, row 0, we see 4 different candidates with a certain confidence value. So this is actually the height of that correlation peak that we've detected for this specific key guess. So we've guessed, oh, what if this key is DE in hex or 222? Then we get a correlation trace with a spike at 0.5964. And for the next candidate, which happened to be 43, we only see a spike of 0.173. So there's actually huge difference in the spike. So I'm actually pretty confident this is the right key value. So I show only the top 4 candidates for each key byte. Of course, there's 256 of them. And then I rinse and repeat this for every key byte. So you get this big table. And then in the end, the tool puts it all together and it calculates what key it was. And then it verifies the key with one plain text ciphertext combination to check whether it was actually the correct one. And it reads dead beef 0123456 7 cafe bay 89 ABCDEF, which is not really chosen at random. That's something that we of course programmed earlier. But this is kind of what the output looks like when you're doing the actual key extraction. But yeah, you need more. I probably picked the wrong spot, or I didn't do the correct processing in our earlier trace. Which, you know, shows that this is a harder step than just the leakage detection. Any questions on CPA before I move into countermeasures and then lunch? Okay. So countermeasures are the flip side of everything that we've been talking about this morning. So every time I took a step, be it acquisition, signal processing, t-test, CPA, they're always based on assumptions that an attacker has to make or find out. And you as a defender is to try to break those. So what you really in the end fundamentally are trying to do is break that relation between the side channel signals, because there are always going to be signals coming out of your device, but you want to break the relation between that and the key being processed, data being processed. If there's no link between those two, if it's just statistically independent, I cannot detect what's going on the inside. So then you need to go into fault injection, which is this afternoon. So there's a few things you can do. You can reduce the data leakage, so try to get the data down. You can add more noise on top of it, because it's in the end about the signal to noise ratio. You can confuse the alignment, so make sure that things aren't lined up properly. And you can even go into interesting techniques where you mask the cryptographic data. So instead of doing a normal AES implementation, you actually mix in random values during the computation, and then you take those values off at the end. And you do that in a clever way that the thing actually still does AES, but because there's a random element in there, an attacker cannot predict the intermediate values anymore. So that's where you're actually attacking the CPA algorithm itself. And that also is a very fundamental way of addressing it. And to go into these four categories, so reducing data leakage is usually implemented in the chip itself, in the hardware. So you can filter your power signal going out by putting some capacitance somewhere. What an attacker can do is to use electromagnetic analysis instead of power analysis. There's also balanced circuits. I don't know if you've heard of that, but what you can actually do, it's really expensive, but you can double every gate on your chip, or at least in your crypto core, in such a way that there's always the same number of transitions for every clock cycle, no matter what data is being operated on. So your logic gates get a lot bigger, but your power consumption basically goes flat. So then there's also much less to go on for an attacker. We have seen that it works better on or against power analysis than against EM analysis. And that has to do with the fact that when you're doing EM analysis, the direction of the field actually makes a difference. So even though you might be balancing in the power domain, depending on whether your gate is oriented in a certain way, your field lines are going to go in a different direction. So that may not cancel out, but there's also just a spatial effect that even if they are canceling out, if your probe is exactly aligned above it, when it's not exactly over it, you still may have an imbalance. One interesting thing here is also, and that's going back, I guess, to your question also about other constraints. So if you're, for instance, on a low power budget, we've seen, this was in the case of smart cards, if you lower the supply voltage, at some point it started switching off countermeasures because it couldn't afford them. So once you know this trick, we usually run smart cards at a very low voltage. But if you don't know, of course, there's still all these countermeasures that are active. So it buys you maybe a little bit of time in the identification phase of the power. And you will talk about, you can shielding, you can put shielding on top of your chip, which may help some of the EM radiations. You can use power analysis, or you can try to sense at the back of the die. What I'm trying to say here is for every measure, there's a countermeasure and there's a measure, but it does make it harder for an attacker. I'm not saying these things are useless, because every step you make an attacker take extra is another step. If you look at it from a certification point of view, that chain from getting the device to getting the key just gets longer. At some point it gets so long that the certification body says, okay, now it's good enough. So that's kind of the game. Adding noise, there's noise generators, basically put on top of that nice leakage, just the noise signal that you need to get rid of as an attacker. Sometimes you can use electromagnetic analysis for that, or you take more traces and hope that it averages out. That's the dumb approach. That's the amplitude noise. You can also introduce temporal noise. So if you just have a little process before your crypto that for a random amount of time stalls, then your crypto will be dancing around in the traces, which I can use alignment for. But again, if I have noise on top of that, the alignment is going to get really hard. So another countermeasure that really helps. For some algorithms, you can do random ordering of operations. So if operations are not dependent on each other, you can just do a random order of executing them. For instance, silly examples, if you have a software implementation of AES running on an 8-bit core, something really tiny, instead of going through the matrix one byte at a time, you can just jump through the matrix in a different order. for instance, for the S-box or the key edition or things like that. And then an attacker, it's really hard to tell which bytes you're actually processing. But also, it looks like things are aligned, but it's not. The dumb approach is to take more traces and hope that eventually the misordering just becomes part of the noise that cancels out. And you can do active shielding, so I have something on top of your die that generates noise. Clock jitter is also something that we typically see. It's the fact that a clock on a chip isn't perfectly static, or perfectly, fix the one frequency, it's always drifting a little bit. You can use that drift also to confuse alignment. Random process interrupts. Basically mentioned that already, but if you insert these timing variations, there's actually some techniques that we use. It's called elastic alignment. So instead of shifting traces with respect to each other, we can locally stretch and expand them. So it's much more computationally intensive, but you can basically squeeze out these random delays and align things again. Then I talked about masking. So this is the one where you XOR some random value on top of your data. But you actually need to do a few more things, right? Because you can't just XOR random data and then hope it works out at the end. So you need to recalculate, for instance, your S-boxes in such a way that at least virtually the mask is taken off. Then you get the actual S-box calculation and you apply the mask again. Same for mixed columns. So you work through your algorithm that way, but you break this relation. There's also attacks on that. And that actually deals with the fact that if two different intermediate states are masked with the same mask, what I can do is instead of looking at one column of the power use, I'm going to look at two when these two intermediate values are being processed. But because they have the same mask, and let's say one value is X XOR the mask and one value is Y XOR the mask, I can make a prediction on what the XOR of those two masked values would be, which is X XOR the mask, Y XOR the mask, which is the same as X XOR Y. So the mask falls out of the equation. But I need to look at two points in time now and recombine them in some way. So I've actually made the attack quadratic in the number of samples. So that's also a huge increase for the attacker. The computation that they need to do. But then masking is also not cheap to implement if you're doing it in hardware or even. So that was just an overview of generally what the countermeasures are that you can do. There's a bunch more, and you can look up in the literature what there is. This also more or less rounds off the day. So. There's a lot more, but not this morning. So this was really scratching the surface. So I try to at least highlight for you guys the process of going from an acquisition to signal processing, leakage detection, and doing the key extraction. But each of those topics I can talk about for hours. Just plain TVLA as it was proposed initially, it's a really good indicator for strong leakage. If your device has some countermeasures, you have to do some more work in order to actually get either the leakage, the T spikes to visualize, or the attacks to succeed. So we covered the basics today. It's not about does something leak or not. It's about how much does it leak, and is this sufficient for your either internal business case, or is it sufficient for your certification body to say it's approved? Now, if I let a system like this run for a year on a system, I'm sure I can get all kinds of keys out. But at the same time, a lot of certification bodies, after a couple months of effort, say, okay, this is good enough for our case. So don't implement more countermeasures than you need, but do implement a sufficient number. All right, any questions that you want to interpose between now and lunch? Okay, so this afternoon I'll be talking about fault injection. You're of course welcome to come back. I'll be around here for a couple more minutes.